Baghdad went quiet today after a Shiite cleric told his supporters who'd stormed government buildings to go home.
Iraqis feel very disrespected, demeaned, dehumanized by the violence.
We hear how Iraq got to this point. I'm Carol Hills. Also, long COVID promises to be an abiding consequence of the pandemic.
I was unable to walk properly. I was unable to talk properly. I wasn't able to breathe properly.
Why our guest believes how we study it needs to change. And in the far north, the Russian war is turbocharging the conversation about domestic clean energy.
If we want to reach our decarbonization goal, for many of the solutions, we're going to need minerals. And minerals can be found here.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We start in Iraq today, where the streets were quiet after a night of violence. The capital of Baghdad erupted into chaos last night after supporters of a powerful Shiite cleric stormed into the heavily fortified Green Zone. They occupied government buildings, and violent clashes broke out between rival militia groups. At least 24 people were killed. The Shiite leader, Muqtada al-Sadr, had announced on Monday that he was stepping away from politics. But today, he told his supporters to go home and stop all protests, peaceful or otherwise. The Royal Shirin Jafari reports on what led up to this dangerous moment.
In a press conference on Monday, Muqtada al-Sadr urged his followers to leave the streets immediately, and they did. They left Baghdad's Green Zone in their armored vehicles, waving their weapons in the air. But just hours before, parts of the Iraqi capital looked like a war zone. Rival militia groups clashed throughout the night, terrifying residents living nearby.
We are starting to hear heavy gunfire, especially around the area where we live.
32-year-old Safa Ahmad could see the fighting from the window of her family's apartment.
In the middle of the Green Zone, there is a huge fire. I see the smoke from my window.
Ahmad lives with her husband and their 5-year-old daughter. When I reached her, she told me she had gone grocery shopping early Monday morning, but she couldn't find some of the basic staples.
We didn't find the bread, we didn't find egg. People were gathering stuff from the supermarket like it's war.
Iraq's security forces imposed a nationwide curfew on Monday, and Ahmad says people were panic buying in case the situation turned more violent. The unrest comes after Iraqi politicians have spent much of the last year squabbling instead of forming a government. It was Muqtada al-Sadr's party that won the majority of the parliament seats in last October's election. But the powerful Shiite cleric wasn't able to form a coalition because he didn't want to negotiate a power-sharing agreement with other Shia leaders. Instead, Sadr withdrew his lawmakers from the parliament, demanded new elections, and now he says he's walking away from politics altogether. Shamron Maku teaches international relations at Boston University.
What we've seen since June is this kind of growing culmination and rift between al-Sadr and other established political elites in Iraq, primarily Sunnis and Kurds, but also, and I think importantly, other Shia factions.
Some of those Shiite factions are supported by Iran, but Sadr has presented himself as an opponent of foreign intervention and interference. And Marco says this has won him a lot of support among Iraqis.
A lot of disenfranchised youth. Iraq has a really high youth population, and the youth tend to kind of gravitate towards Muqtada al-Sadr because of his nationalist rhetoric and his non-interventionist rhetoric.
Marco says Sadr has said he would resign as a political leader in the past, but he has remained one of Iraq's most powerful figures.
I'm not placing too much weight on the fact that he said that he's quitting politics as, you know, thinking or signaling that he will no longer become an influential political figure.
So this is not the end of the cleric in Iraqi politics, she says. Sadr's announcement on Monday comes after another major resignation. Grand Ayatollah Kadhim Hosseini al-Hariri, who is a marja, or a source of emulation for Shia Muslims, said he was stepping down from his role. He said Iraqis should look to Iran's supreme leader for guidance. Ruba Ali al-Hassani is a postdoctoral fellow at Lancaster University in the UK. She says Hariri's resignation has raised eyebrows.
Marja actually don't resign. It's a lifelong commitment. So Muqtada al-Sadr replied that Hariri looks like he was coerced into resigning.
coerced into resigning by Iran, she says, and that has angered Sadr's supporters. Whatever is behind these two announcements this week, Iraq remains politically divided without a government.
We still have a government that's temporary, unelected, and has no authority to pass any law or any decisions. There is no budget yet, and it's almost September.
And Hassani says the Iraqi public will continue to deal with the consequences.
Iraqis feel very disrespected, demeaned, ignored, overlooked, unheard, dehumanized by the violence that is taking place.
On Monday, the United Nations mission in Iraq called for peace. In a statement, it warned that the very survival of the Iraqi state is at stake. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
You may have heard this news yesterday. A new study shows that melting ice from Greenland will contribute a whopping 10-plus inches to sea level rise. Previous widespread estimates put the max at about 5 inches. To understand how this fits into our larger understanding of rising sea levels, we turn to David Holland. He's a New York University professor who spent years studying ice in both Greenland and Antarctica. So, David, give us an idea of what 10 inches of sea level rise means in terms of what risks going underwater.
The risk is enormous. It may, to some people, not seem like much, but let's consider the last century or so has seen a rise of about that amount of water, about 10 inches. Yet here we're talking about all of that equivalency coming from one place, Greenland, let alone what surprises the others might have. The big elephant in the room, Antarctica. If you've had a chance to spend time on South Beach in Miami or parts of the Carolinas, they're already right at the edge.
What about a place like Venice, which is kind of, you know, in the water already? Will that definitely be underwater?
Venice has been increasingly undergoing severe floods. And so that's just more unfortunate news for Venice. So to see it kick up from 5, from the IPCC estimate, to now 10 is really shocking. You might remember Hurricane Sandy and its impact. This contribution from Greenland, what it does is it sets the background sea level higher than we'd expect. And that combined with the perfect storm, which we had in Sandy, which is a high tide and a storm pointed directly pushing water at New York City. Together, the higher background, the tide, and the storm are probably going to become more likely events. Certainly hard to imagine how they'd become less likely.
How did you feel when you read the results of this new study?
I was just actually surprised. Sometimes I look for ups and downs in science, which is as we refine our knowledge, we learn that, hey, something's not as bad as we thought, or hey, it's worse. It's kind of a detective game. We're trying to figure out what's happening to ice on this planet. Ice on the planet is a really big player. 10% of the ice of the planet is glaciers like Greenland, Antarctica. 15% is ice in the ocean that forms seasonally. So a quarter of our planet, of the blue-white marble, is white ice. And we're seeing that white ice disappear at alarming rates. When I started my PhD studying sea ice in the 90s, no single person on Earth would have said Arctic sea ice will change in our lifetime.
So should we expect other projections to be revised upward?
The really big story is Antarctica. It is massive. It's the size of the United States, and it's about 2 miles thick of ice sitting at the bottom of the planet, if you will. I've always thought of Greenland as a smaller player, but this study really kind of shakes that ground for me, and the recognition that Greenland is now a very significant player. If we turn again to Antarctica, instead of the scale that we're talking here, 10 inches or so, lower bound, it could be higher, 20 inches. In Antarctica, we're talking those numbers get replaced by feet, something of the scale of 10 feet, 20 feet. 30 feet. That's what's at stake in Antarctica. And that would rewrite everything around the world for the coastline. And what's going on in Antarctica is, you might think, originally when I started this research, it was all very theoretical. And in fact, the early studies that other folks have done in the late 60s and 70s said, hey, Antarctica, Greenland, parts of these could be unstable. This was a mathematical study. And then as satellites were put in space over the decades, we noticed the places that were theoretically unstable seemed to really be falling apart. I'm just returning from Antarctica, where one glacier, perhaps the most important in the world, Thwaites, right now is in complete disarray, and it's melting something like 300 feet per year, 300 feet per year at the bottom. That's not sustainable. And that glacier is holding back a large part of West Antarctica. And if that goes, then there will be a very big change on this planet.
Now, the authors of this study, they say this amount of melt is already baked into climate change. There's nothing we can do going forward to cut emissions that will get us back down below that 10 inches of sea level rise. Is that a widely held belief or is it contested?
So this study is very, very new. And I think it will be both. There'll be people on both sides of that as we go forward from the science point of view. It's a new study and it's pushing the envelope. The idea that something's baked in, I think we have to get a little bit used to that. The air that we breathe now in the last 100 years has risen from 280 parts per million to 400 now and probably heading to 500. So that change in the air is real. And that carbon dioxide is not coming out of the atmosphere anytime soon, certainly not within the next 1,000 years. So the fact that the planet is getting warmer, you may have seen the story last week or so, the Arctic parts of it have warmed 7 times faster than any other place on Earth.
Whoa.
The Arctic is responding beyond our models, beyond our expectations. It's far warming far faster than anyone imagined. So I think that we are going to be constantly revising what we think is happening to the climate system. Perhaps scientists are sometimes impatient or the public. The truth is, this is a generational problem and it's going to require generations to solve this and make these answers more solid. You might say, we don't have time for that. Well, what else are we going to do?
So if I'm hearing you right, as the technology and methods of research improve, we seem to only be getting worse news in terms of ice melt and sea level rise.
Yeah, and I think hidden in that is a phenomena of nature called abrupt change. Our mathematical understanding is kind of, we've built models and understanding of nature that are smooth, but in fact, nature is abrupt. Our history of the planet has, of course, been abrupt change throughout. We were once an ice-covered planet, a snowball. That somehow disappeared, and we emerged as life some 600 million years ago. There have been mass extinctions along the way. Certainly hope we're not in the process of having our dinosaur moment, but abrupt change happens, and our mathematics is really not up to that yet, nor our understanding of nature.
David Holland is a professor of mathematics and atmospheric science at New York University. He's spent years studying glacier melt. He's been discussing with us a study released yesterday that shows faster ice melt in Greenland than previously understood. Thanks a lot, David.
Thank you, Carol.
Getting sick from COVID-19 hits people differently. For people who experience long COVID, the illness can be confounding long after their initial diagnosis.
A few weeks to months later, their life got pulled under them. They are bedbound, housebound, unable to function. They're losing their jobs. So this is like, this population deserves prioritizing for both research and treatment and also support.
What we are still learning about long COVID, that's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. We're at a weird spot in the pandemic. Many people are acting as if it's essentially over. For them, COVID is part of everyday life now. For others, the immunocompromised or those with pre-existing conditions, the urgency of the early days of the crisis has hardly faded. And then there are those with long COVID. Some of them are in their third year of grappling with a wide range of symptoms. That includes language teacher Elizabeth Semper in Spain, who got COVID early in February of 2020. Since then, she says she's had issues with her heart and breathing, visual impairment and hearing loss, and persistent neurological issues.
I was unable to walk properly. I was unable to talk properly. I was unable to breathe properly after any tiny activity, laundry or whichever.
Semper says she's improved a bit with rehab, but she's not fully recovered.
For example, I'm still not able to read a book. Because sometimes I cannot understand what I'm reading, or I've already forgotten what I've already read. It's like I've had some car crash, but I hadn't. And every day it's changing. It's very hard to explain all these.
Author and New York Times columnist Zeynep Tufekci says it's time to consider new ways of understanding and treating long COVID. Zeynep, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, I think we have to start with the most basic question. What exactly is long COVID?
Well, that's a great question. Unfortunately, even though we are entering the third year, we still have an umbrella definition that includes many different kinds of aftermaths that range from being a little tired, having a bit of difficulty sort of breathing for a few weeks, to much more serious things, including serious debilitating conditions that are chronic and that have left some people even bedbound and without able to concentrate.
And we've been here before, right? I mean, after the flu pandemics in 1918 and even 1889, we saw this phenomenon around the world of lingering symptoms after recovery, didn't we?
That is correct. In fact, when I started digging up to see how far back I could find such neurological aftermath from viral epidemics, the first instance I found in medical writing was from 1385, a flu epidemic in Germany, where they were noting these neurological symptoms that appeared afterwards. So in some sense, we should have been better prepared because pandemics have produced such waves before.
What are some of the most common symptoms of people who are experiencing long COVID?
There are many kinds of long COVID. For some people, the word fatigue doesn't capture how profound debilitating it can be. It's as if, you know, you can't even just go brush your teeth without needing to rest for many hours. And some of the advice we give to normal people, you know, after a bit of illness and deconditioning, we say, go exercise more, you know, push yourself a little bit more. That's what I do when I feel a little down. That is very counterproductive for that subgroup of people, which is why it's really important to define these categories so that people can get the appropriate medical and clinical advice.
In your article, you talk about how people who describe long COVID symptoms to their healthcare providers are often met with suspicion. Is that just the case in the U.S. or is that happening in other countries?
Unfortunately, this is a global phenomenon. One of the doctors from Mayo Clinic who works on chronic illnesses told me that medicine has a way of trying to ignore what it doesn't understand. And we've essentially abandoned, I think, a large number of people on their own. Even the sort of very advanced clinicians I've talked with at Columbia University, where I'm at right now, at Mayo Clinic, elsewhere, they all told me they're concocting their treatment protocols themselves, right? There's not a lot of trials. There's, in fact, very few treatment trials going on. So even the best, most advanced doctors who've been dealing with similar issues for decades are reduced to just ad hoc protocols because there is no proper evidence-based clinical guidance for them. And that, to me, is just unacceptable.
So where around the globe is long COVID taken more seriously, and what steps are being taken?
In the UK, there's at least proper measurement through a survey. I think it's the best survey. I usually look to it. But what I hear from patients in the UK is that while the measurements are there, the treatment options and kind of the way they're treated isn't really different. So I would say that this is a global blind spot for medicine. In fact, the fact that we had to rediscover this, despite having centuries of documentation of these sort of waves of complications after the acute phase of a pandemic or a large epidemic somewhere, I think speaks to that.
You've described some of the symptoms and the disregard for patients, but what do we know about the actual disease mechanism itself?
That's a great question. There is a lot of research going on right now, and some of the theories include persistence of viral reservoirs. There is structural damage sometimes during the illness and in the aftermath that creates some of these things, perhaps with combination. It could be a reactivation of viruses like Epstein-Barr or herpes viruses that are seen with other post-viral conditions. It could be a combination of all of these in that some patients might have more of A and more of B, and it could combine in various ways. But what we're seeing is that a viral infection can, and not just for this virus, occasionally cause these very complicated immune system dysregulation and other kinds of problems that for some people are chronic and debilitating.
Danish researchers have found a link between neurodegenerative disorders like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and both COVID and influenza. How might that discovery shed light on long COVID?
That's a great example, because what I think we might be at the cusp of, if we do this right, and in fact, in my article, I call for a post-viral conditions institute, like at the national level, the way we treat cancer seriously. We have a National Cancer Institute. If we sort of look at all these post-viral conditions together, I think it might unlock clues to many, many diseases, because one example I give is multiple sclerosis, which early on, patients were dismissed. Sometimes it happens even to this day. And then, you know, imaging allowed brain lesions to be seen, and there's more evidence that patients stopped being dismissed as much, but still the cause was unknown. And just this year, we got a study showing it follows from an earlier infection with the Epstein-Barr virus. I just keep wondering, how many of these are there? How many of these long-term conditions that are, in fact, post-viral conditions? And more importantly, how many of these can we prevent if we start vaccinating against them? It could just unlock so much benefit, not just for long COVID sufferers, but also it would benefit the rest of us, I think, for the long term to take it seriously, because it's clearly this overlooked area that will likely answer many questions about chronic and debilitating conditions that we don't at the moment understand or have a way to treat or prevent.
Author Zeynep Tufekci writes a newsletter called Insight. She's also a columnist for the New York Times. Thanks a lot, Zeynep.
Thank you for talking with me.
More stories from around the globe are still coming your way in the second half of the show. You're listening to The World. The Dutch government is being accused of inhumane treatment of asylum seekers. The NGO suing says political rhetoric against migrants is partly to blame.
As long as people are told that people that come here spend most of their days robbing and stealing, then it's a tough job to explain to people what the reality is.
That story and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Ukraine's military says its long-awaited counteroffensive in the south of the country has begun. In his nightly address, President Zelensky said he would not offer details about the blitz. But he warned that if the Russian troops hope to survive, it was time for them to flee. It's difficult to verify what's happening on the ground because members of the military are being urged not to talk to the media. So to learn more, we reached out to Michael Kaufman. He directs Russia Studies at the Center for Naval Analyses, a research group in Virginia. Michael, Ukraine's military says it's broken through Russia's defenses in several places in the occupied Kherson region in the south of the country. Is that what you're hearing?
Well, it seems to be the rumor, at least right now, it's very difficult to confirm. I think the actual claim is that Ukrainian forces have broken through the first initial line of Russian defenses. I don't know whether or not it's true, but it's important that folks understand that the Russian military likely has several different lines of defenses across this region that it occupies, and that this is undoubtedly probably not going to be a very quick operation.
Russian officials say the counteroffensive is failing. Do we know much about Ukraine's first goal in this surge?
Well, it appears Ukrainian forces are trying to advance into the occupied territory of Kherson, west of the river, or Dnieper. And their ultimate objective is very likely to be the regional capital itself, the city of Kherson, in an attempt to press Russian forces across the river onto the eastern side of the riverbank.
I understand they were also trying to destroy four bridges the Russians used to supply the city of Kherson.
That's right. Actually, for some time now, Ukraine has been using long-range guided rockets to target the road and rail bridges that connect that region and Russia's foothold in the region to the rest of the Russian forces in the southern part of Ukraine.
Russian troops captured Kherson in February. They've had 6 months to dig in and prepare for this counteroffensive. Is retaking Kherson a realistic goal?
I think it's very much a realistic goal, but without knowing much about Ukrainian forces, or to some extent the disposition of Russian forces, it's very difficult to evaluate the likelihood of Ukraine's success. But given the equipment they have and some of the successes they've had in the past, it's certainly possible.
I mean, one other interpretation was that it's an effort by Ukraine to give their people and their allies a kind of psychological boost.
Well, that may be so, but it's also very much a practical war aim. I mean, Ukraine at some point has to change from a defense in-depth strategy to a counteroffensive in order to retake territory. And I think many in Ukraine do see the current time period as a potential window of opportunity before winter approaches.
Officials in Kyiv say their soldiers are using U.S.-supplied HIMARS rocket systems to blow up key crossings on the Dnieper River, and they're targeting makeshift Russian pontoon bridges. What's the challenge in getting at those bridges?
I think the main challenge is that the Russian military tries to repair them, and the Russian military has been trying to build a barge-type bridge alongside one of the main bridges as well. So the Ukrainian military has been striking them. The Russian military had been trying to repair them in order to make them serviceable for military convoys, and then Ukraine's been restriking them again.
There are some stories out today describing how Ukrainians have built wooden decoys that look like the U.S.-supplied HIMAR rocket systems, and they say they've tricked Russia into wasting expensive long-range cruise missiles on these fakes. What do you think of that?
Certainly possible. Decoys are a innovative way to try to get opponents to waste their long-range precision-guided weapons while searching for your systems deployed behind the lines.
What are you going to be looking for in the next week or so? What are kind of key indicators for you?
What I would be looking for in the coming weeks is first credible evidence that Ukrainian forces are in fact making progress and advancing to Russian lines, which means they are capturing towns, and there's visual evidence of the fact that they've taken them. In these kinds of situations, both sides make extensive claims and counterclaims. It's very difficult to reconcile them, because you'll hear both sides claiming that they've taken or lost some part of territory. Also, visual evidence to see what's happening with Russian forces and their ability to resupply across the river, because it's likely to become much more precarious in the coming days. And any major official announcements coming out of either the Ukrainian political leadership or from the Russian political leadership or the Russian military that might suggest what their plans or next moves might be.
Michael Kaufman directs Russia Studies at the Center for Naval Analyses, a research group in Virginia. We've been talking with him about a new Ukrainian counteroffensive in the Kherson region. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks for having me on your program.
The Dutch government is being accused of, quote, inhumane treatment of refugees. That's from a lawsuit being brought by an NGO called the Dutch Refugee Council. The group says the conditions at government-run migrant reception centers are just not acceptable. One facility has been described as a health hazard after a three-month-old baby died there last week. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry has more.
Ter Apel is a small village in the northeast of the Netherlands. It's where most people must go to have their asylum claims processed. And the migrant reception centre there is massively overcrowded. A sports hall nearby has been opened up to accommodate the hundreds of people arriving every day. But even that's not enough.
Last night it was windy and it was so cold and we couldn't sleep after 3 a.m.
Ibrahim Alfawal is among hundreds of asylum seekers forced to sleep outside on the muddy ground last week. Alfawal is from Syria, he told Euronews, and doesn't feel safe sleeping outside. Local residents aren't happy either. A few days ago, hundreds of them walked to the outskirts of the facility, calling on their government to shut it down. They carry placards that read, "Real refugees OK, troublemakers go away." One resident said he doesn't mind what he calls genuine refugees coming from places like Syria.
20% is my eigen volk wat uit vluchtelingen komt. De rest is allemaal uit Afrika. Heel veel Somaliërs, Djibouti.
It's those coming from Africa he objects to, he tells a Dutch reporter. Later that day, one asylum seeker tells the reporter that he's been pelted with eggs and yogurt by people driving by in a car. and there's nowhere for him to clean himself up.
We don't have place to clean, we don't have home, we don't have nothing, so even I don't have more clothes to change. Please, Netherlands, be friendly.
The Dutch Council for Refugees says part of the problem is that politicians at a national level are spreading lies about the migrants and asylum seekers. Sander Schaap is a spokesperson with the council.
As long as people are told that people that come here don't have a right to be here, that they spend most of their days robbing and stealing, then it's a tough job to explain to people what the reality is, and that these are mostly people that fled from either Syria, Turkey, Yemen, Afghanistan with their families and are hoping to build a better life here.
The Dutch branch of Doctors Without Borders has sent medics to the camp at Ter Apel. They usually work in war zones. This is the first time they've been called upon to deal with the crisis at home. In the last few days, Dutch authorities have started busing the asylum seekers to other parts of the Netherlands, but some are refusing to go. They're afraid their asylum applications will not be processed if they leave the Ter Apel camp. Some Dutch politicians are now calling for a total ban on migrants and asylum seekers arriving in the country until the current situation is resolved. Prime Minister Mark Rutte told reporters this is not an option.
Ik ga daar niet over hebben wat ik allemaal vind, want het kan niet. Het gaat niet.
It can't be done, Rutte says. The Netherlands is part of the European Union. We would have to leave the EU, he said. The Prime Minister says he's ashamed of what's happening at Ter Apel and he's promising to provide more housing for asylum seekers in the coming months. But the government also plans to stop providing visas for relatives of those hoping to join family members in the Netherlands, unless they already have housing. Sander Schaap with the Refugee Council says this proposal is just cruel.
Instead of finding the solution where it hurts in political terms, they came up with measures that hurt people where it hurts the most, namely keeping them apart from their children even longer than is already the case. So that's particularly harsh.
The lawsuit brought by the Dutch Refugee Council is focused on conditions of the camps. Schaap says there was no other option but to sue the government.
Basically just, you know, simple things. Give people a bed, give them decent food, medical care, a shower, have children be able to go to school. Very basic things the government is not providing. And there's tens of thousands of asylum seekers now in conditions that are just not, simply not good enough to house human beings.
A court hearing is scheduled for September 15th. Schaap says he's confident that the Refugee Council will win the case. But whether it will make much of a difference for many asylum seekers in the Netherlands right now, Schaap tells me he's not so sure. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
An astonishing one-third of Pakistan is now underwater. According to the country's climate minister, over 1,000 people have been killed since heavy monsoon rains started in June, and tens of thousands of people have been displaced from their homes. Pakistan is now asking for $160 million in international aid to help. Huram Gondal runs the Save the Children office in Pakistan and joins us now from Islamabad. Huram, how would you describe the scale of the disaster that's unfolding in Pakistan right now?
To put it in a very simple word, it's huge. I think it's never been in the history of Pakistan that we have received such a huge floods. It's 7 or 8 cycle of rains. It's across the country. So all of the provinces have been impacted by these rains. In total, if I talk about 33 million people have been affected by these floods, and out of which 11 million are children. And in such situation and disasters, children are the most affected population of the society. So it's a massive scale.
Wow. With a situation as devastating as the one you're describing, what are the most urgent things you need in terms of humanitarian help?
What we have identified as an immediate is the shelter, because around 1 million houses, they have been damaged. So, tents and shelter is the key, and some transitional structure till the time, some solution is being made in terms of, having a reconstruction and all that, because that would going to take time. So shelter is the very urgent kind of a requirement. The crops have damaged. and areas are far flung, so people are really struggling. They're struggling with the food. So food is also absolutely important at this point in time. Along with that, safe drinking water. I mean, a lot of water sources have got contaminated.
The United Nations joined in Pakistan's appeal for $160 million in aid. What is that money needed for, and how quickly does it need to arrive to actually be helpful?
The situation cannot wait for the funds, so it has to be immediate, as soon as possible. UN is also, focused, and the government is on very basic, the shelter, the food, some cash assistance allocation so that people can use that cash according to their needs. Health and nutrition is another area where the support is required, and they have asked for in this appeal. Also, the schools, they have been washed away or destroyed and damaged. So some temporary learning centers in coming days would be required in a massive number.
Is it the situation where the rains and the flooding are still going on? So it's not like a natural disaster that occurs and then you're doing the cleanup and dealing with people. This is sort of still ongoing. Isn't Pakistan still dealing with these rains?
Yes, it's ongoing. I mean, it's more than what was being anticipated. So the cycle is ongoing, the water, the flash floods, the glacier melting. So it's more to do with the climate change. And Pakistan is one of the top 10 countries which are hard hit by the climate. And this is quite a very strong example of a climate change. And yes, they are not stopping these rain spells. So yes, they are keep on adding into the situation and more floods. Still, there are a lot of areas where we are receiving rains, and it's kind of ongoing at the moment. And the predictions are also that in the next couple of weeks we will have these continued spells which will be coming our way.
How has the official government response in Pakistan been? I mean, and has it been effective?
So they are trying their level best, but then again, it's limited capacity and the scale is too big. So that's why government has called on, at least in 66 districts of Pakistan as a hard hit districts, and in total 116 districts. So we remember that this Pakistan is 220 million people country. So it's a huge population which we are talking about. And say if this, 33 million people are affected, and number is growing because, the rains are not stopping. So any capacity can easily be challenged under the circumstances.
Hooram, how long is it going to take for Pakistan to rebuild after a disaster of this scale?
Well, with the capacity, with the resources, with the scale, I think it's years of hard work which can take us back to the situation. Otherwise, I mean, the scale is so huge, the infrastructure, the road networks, the bridges, the basic health units, the schools, the number of schools, the livestock, the land which have been the cultivatable land, because still the water logging is there. So it's very hard for them to crop the next crops which goes in a sequence of an year. So resulting in the number of houses. And remember, these are more sort of the people who struggle for their daily life. So it's very hard for them to come back to the status which they had prior to floods. It's a long-term effort, at least a decade effort, to address the damage at this scale.
Hooram Gondal is the Pakistan director of Save the Children. He joined us from the capital, Islamabad. Hooram, thank you.
Thank you very much, Karen.
Deadly clashes have broken out between militias backed by the rival governments in Libya. The UN Weather Agency is warning of drier than average conditions this year for the Horn of Africa, and the World Health Organization has fired the top director for its Western Pacific region over accusations of racism and abusive behavior. Our morning newsletter keeps you up to date on the most important news headlines, along with context to break down complicated stories. Subscribe to Top of the World at our website. Head to theworld.org/newsletters. The war in Ukraine has put Europe in a difficult spot. Most European allies support Ukraine against Russian aggression, but at the same time, they're sending money to Russia to buy its oil and gas. This dilemma has accelerated conversations about getting off of Russian fossil fuels and off of fossil fuels altogether. The debate is especially relevant in the far north of Europe, where the Arctic could provide answers as Europe looks to diversify its energy sources. Katie Toth has this story from Tromsø, Norway.
Cruise uphill on Tromsø's local gondola and you'll peer down on a cute little Arctic village full of students, fishermen, and art exhibits. It doesn't come off as the kind of place that would house a decommissioned nuclear sub-base carved into a mountain, something that sounds like it's straight out of a James Bond movie. But as the ships weave their way in from the Norwegian Sea to Tromsø's port, you realize this is also a city of connections. Tourists line up at the airport. This is their last stop before the high Arctic islands of Svalbard. Students sit in cafes arguing about European literature. And foreign ministers, ambassadors, and scientists, they're all gathering to talk about what's next for the North at the city's big annual conference.
We meet during the season of light, surrounded by darkness. Welcome to Arctic Frontiers 2022.
We're here to discuss the Arctic right now, but what's on so many European minds is energy and the crisis that they're crashing into.
It's the summer and the winter is coming.
And our energy prices are rocketing.
The dependency from external energy sources, also external energy sources which come from authoritarian regimes.
In the urgency to move off Russian energy, Europe has gotten pretty desperate. Germany has given the okay to restart some dormant coal power plants, and it's reconsidered its plans to shut down nuclear power. Meanwhile, just turn on the news and you can see how the country I'm sitting in is racing to help.
Norway, Europe's second biggest exporter behind Russia, has been pushing up production to help the European Union.
Terje Aasland is Norway's Minister for Petroleum. One thing Norway has committed to do is continue pumping at just about 100% of production capacity over the summer. That should help, is that right?
Yes, I hope so. In this critical situation, I think the most important thing Norway can do is to be a stable, reliable producer for oil and gas.
And this move, it is making money. The value of Norway's Arctic offshore LNG deposits has skyrocketed. Profits from the state-owned energy company Equinor power up socialized medicine, education, the public welfare system. And in the second quarter this year, Equinor's net income was more than three times what it was in the same period last year.
We posted some strong results this morning, 17 billion of adjusted earnings.
You must have watched this unbelievable pivot we've seen from policymakers, from our political masters. One minute they want you to get out of ONG as quickly as possible. Next minute they're saying, how much can you produce for me?
This windfall has led to a new tension in Norway. See, humanitarian aid is one of the cornerstones of Norway's statecraft. And now Norwegians have to ask, is our country war profiteering? Should this money be sent to help refugees, or should it be helping local Norwegians who've seen their own energy prices skyrocket over recent years? And alongside this, there's an ongoing question. How long can this country keep making fossil fuel money when we know climate change is happening as we speak? That's why some advocates say Europe's energy security push has to go green. At the conference, Martin Summerkorn with the World Wildlife Fund said the conflict with Russia could actually make this easier for Europe to do.
For the next decades, there is an estimate of $1 trillion being invested in the Arctic. Lots of that is actually supposedly be hydrocarbon developments in the Russian north.
See, Russia has invested a lot in building itself up as an Arctic energy powerhouse. And for years before, on regulatory meetings or discussions about freezing extraction in the Arctic, it was not super pumped on those ideas, but now it's not going to be in those meetings anyway.
There's a real opportunity for those countries who seek for solutions to actually do better than they could have done with dragging Russia along, to put it this way. The same is true for environmental regulations. We see actually through the sanctions, environmental regulations in Russia being bent. Why don't the rest of the Arctic countries use this opportunity to be even better?
It's not ideal, but maybe there is lemonade to be made from lemons here.
And so I think this transition actually will not get a break, and it might actually get some resolve from the world uniting around global issues.
In May, the European Commission announced a plan worth hundreds of billions of dollars focused on speeding up Europe's green shift so that it won't need Russian energy. But green energy will also take energy.
Energy, a big topic in the background of the war, and here Arctic can play a huge role.
Virginia Sinkevicius, the EU Commissioner for the Environment, outlined his government's vision on a panel. Get off Russian Arctic fuel, thanks in part to European Arctic resources. The EU Arctic strategy specifically points to the Arctic as a place with the resources it needs for a green transition, both from EU members like Finland and from partners like Norway.
If we want to reach our decarbonization goal, for many of the solutions, we're going to need minerals. And minerals can be found here.
It's not just minerals in the Arctic that can help with decarbonization. It's also water power, hydrogen, geothermal, and wind. But asking the Arctic to provide this energy isn't always simple. In fact, that last one, wind power, it can get controversial. Because while Europe is fighting for its energy security, wind power projects can also conflict with the priorities of indigenous land users. For The World, I'm Katie Toth.
Tomorrow, we'll continue this story with a look at what's at stake for the indigenous Sami people as Nordic wind projects move forward.
It has been talks about just transition, the so-called green transition, and there is nothing just about killing a culture.
Katie Toth's reporting is from Things That Go Boom, a podcast about global security and foreign policy from PRX. And that's it for us today. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.